Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's 10 p.m. here in Central Europe in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's raining outside, it's cold, and it's finally autumn in its full swing. Not the warm Indian summer autumn we've been having hitherto, but it's actually cold right now. And tonight I have a very special guest. Tonight with me is Dr. Tomislav Sunic. He is one of the greatest thinkers of our movement, of the dissident Reich, of the French New Right, which has somehow or other bled into the North American New Right, which is, of course, Greg Johnson's project of importing French New Right thought into the North American political discourse. Dr. Sunic, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me, and I'd like to extend my greetings to our colleagues, your colleagues down in Macedonia, down in Eastern Europe, hopefully also Central Europe, and of course to my colleagues and friends in the United States and Australia, if they are tuned in. So thank you for being here, folks.
And we are here tonight to discuss a subject that, well, something we two have in common. We live in a very special area of the world, you and I, Dr. Sunic, the Balkans, the former Yugoslavia. But before we get into the meat of the business, let me just say we still have our fundraiser here on countercurrents.com, and you should donate to our fundraiser through entropystream.live/countercurrents. Now you can see that ticking at the bottom of the screen right below us here on the if you have video, and if not, our heroic moderators will be kind enough to put that in the DLive and Odyssey chats for your easy access. We are streaming live on DLive. We are streaming live on Odyssey. And as usual, this stream has been, well, at least in part, brought to you by Alyaska Chaga. I always drink Alyaska Chaga during these live streams, and I drink it on my off days as well because it's just so full of antioxidants. It is a fine beverage. What a divine smell. If I could live stream smell, people, if I could live stream smell. And that is the introduction. And now that we've gotten the crass financial concerns out of the way, Dr. Sunic, you and I, we both come from the former Yugoslavia. I'm a Macedonian, you're a Croat. We have to a greater or lesser degree witnessed the fallout from the fall of the state, from its dissolution. Somewhere it was bloody, somewhere it was peaceful, and sometimes I think that those of us who got out of it with less blood, well, we may have paid a higher price. But let's start with something very simple. How did Yugoslavia come to be? I mean, it's not an exactly intuitive idea. Let's get these quarreling nations together. Why not stick them together, right? Who came up with this? How did this idea come to be?
All right, just before I start, I would like to point out some methodological details, especially for our friends in the States. I certainly would appreciate if we could draw some parallels between the Balkanization of Yugoslavia, whatever that may mean, and the Balkanization, or the current Balkanization, we can say, in the United States of America, and to some extent also in the European Union. Of course, this expression Balkanization has a somewhat pejorative connotation in the Balkans itself, ironically, but it has a wider, somewhat sinister meaning as well, especially when a certain entity like ex-Yugoslavia, or tomorrow it can be South Africa as well, it can be India, when this entity faces centrifugal, we can say, forces, and when it simply disappears from the map. And this is exactly what happened with ex-Yugoslavia twice in the former centuries. So just before we go on, I wouldn't like to pester our listeners, but we certainly need to make a detour, and we have to delve a little bit into history. I will not, as I said, I'm not going to bother you with many details and many data, But what you need to know that the idea of Yugoslavia was quite different from the practice, or rather from the reality of Yugoslavia. The whole idea of Yugoslavia was a form of political romanticism. Mm-hmm. It was basically an offshoot in the first half of the 19th century of Pan-Slavism. Pan-Slavism, of course, think a little bit about Dostoevsky. Later on, we have Solzhenitsyn, we can mention him then, who actually had this mystical idea, we can say, some big thinkers back in Russia, in Imperial Russia, shortly after the Napoleonic Wars. You know, so the Russians became a big factor in the geopolitics of Europe. And then they developed this idea how all Slavic tribes, including Croats, Macedonians, Bulgarians, or for that matter, Poles as well, Czechs, Slovaks, you know, we're talking about the entire Central Europe and Eastern Europe, if you can picture that on your in your mind, how they should be all scooped together under the holy, holy grail, we can say, of the Russian imperial mind. It was well thought over, and I'm not going to ridicule that. It was just a good idea. But my idea, given the fact that I'm a hardcore skeptic, and I always have question marks, and I always put myself always in a different perspective, also in the perspective of my foes and enemies. So basically, this Pan-Slavism was a response, and at the same time, it triggered Pan-Germanism, as we say. It actually triggered the appetites of Germany, we can say, of the late 19th century. Although the role of Germany is often, you know, negatively portrayed, the Germans at that time, and I'm not going to posture with that, but I need to tell you that during Bismarck, he had a very solid, very realistic politics in the second half of the 19th century. He was a clever, very clever man. When he got fired by his boss, by Wilhelm II, you know, things became a little bit sour. They became a little bit ugly. And of course, you know, we know what happened with the First World War. So anyway, what you need to know, Yugoslavia was on the heels. It, as in practice, in reality, Yugoslavia emerged on the map after the First World War. Prior to that, contrary to Macedonia, Serbia, or other parts of Eastern Balkans, we can say, Croatia and Slovenia were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And I got to tell you that if you look at the psychology of modern-day Croats are extremely proud of their Germanic set of ties and Germanic context. And they, and of course, they sometimes mimic the Germans a little bit way too much. And they sometimes have those derisive and somewhat defamatory words against the Serbs and the Bosnian Muslims. Not so much, I guess, Macedonia is something else. Croats have traditionally been friends with Macedonia, which is extremely, extremely complicated. The whole issue of those, how can I say, of hatred and, of course, resentments on the one hand and love affair on the other. So keep in mind, Yugoslavia as an entity, as a formal international entity, was created only after the First World War. And of course, Serbia, which by then had already been an independent country, having fought on the side of the English, or the Brits, rather the British, and the United States, and of course, on the side of the French. You know, the French played a very, very big role in the creation of the first Yugoslavia. And even nowadays, you know, the Croats are somewhat suspicious of the French, or French adventures and foreign policy adventures in the Balkans, and especially the Brits. The Brits are not our favorite darlings here. The Germans have traditionally been our darlings in Croatia. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened is that Yugoslavia didn't pass its test, ladies and gentlemen. If there are some students over here, I'm not going to pontificate now whether multiculturalism works or not, but just ask yourself a simple, stupid question, if I can put it that way. Do you know, it's a rhetorical question, do you know of any multicultural country with a long duration? The answer is no way, Jose. I'm not going to speculate about the future of the United States of America, but having lived there and going there quite often, being also a U.S. citizen, by the way, I don't have many illusions about this Biden-esque, Balkan-esque, it's in my adjective, of the United States of America. Who knows? I'm not going to speculate. I'm not going to say certain things which may run counter to whatever I'm not going to be too much explicit, but I guess I'm not very happy with the demographic changes and with the balkanization of the United States of America. And again, I need to quote here Pat Buchanan. I got to also mention his name. He was quite active when my dad in communist Yugoslavia was in prison. He was one of the rare guys, a guy of stature and stamina and character, who actually intervened on behalf of my old man, who was then imprisoned in communist Yugoslavia in the early 80s. Long time, huh? How time flies. Anyway, this first Yugoslavia, which stretched from 1919 until 1941. Now imagine what was the whole situation, folks. You know about the Weimar Germany, you know about the situation in Greece. It was a big transfer of population in the 20s between the Turks and Greece. The whole Europe was pretty much in chaos, similar to some extent to our chaos, current chaos. Although our chaos today, somewhat it's more hybrid, it's more hygienic in a sense, we can say it that way. I'm using my own metaphor, so please apologize.
I don't know how hygienic it is. I mean,
hygienic in a sense that it's COVID prescripted type of a. I'm using this word because we're also talking about hygienic language. I'm using instead of repeating and rehashing this word Orwellian meta speech, I prefer the word hygienique, as the French say. They launched this word, la pensée unique hygienique. It's untranslatable into the English language. This is the beauty of the French language and, of course, the beauty of the German language. So I would encourage our listeners, folks, please do study the foreign languages. It certainly helps a great deal, European foreign languages. Anyway, the first Yugoslavia, it was a monarchic Yugoslavia, to some extent a Xerox copy of of the French Third Republic, because it was basically fostered, it was propelled by the French Foreign Service, by French diplomacy, and it was very shaky. And basically, what happened is nobody was happy. Not a single nation, a single ethnic group within the first Yugoslavia until 1941, be it Macedonia down in the south, which is very close to Greece. Albeit, for instance, further up, then you have a very, very large ethnic Albanian minority nowadays. In the Albanian minority, very close, and in Bosnia, in Macedonia, there are quite a few of them. Keep in mind, it's completely different.
Their numbers are inflated by the Macedonian government. Yeah, of course, for the purposes.
But they have the highest birth rate in Europe. And of course, folks, they are not Slavs, they're just quite different. Of course, most of them are Muslims, but we'll discuss about that quite later on. So basically, folks were unhappy. You know, the whole situation in Europe, the Weimar Europe in the 30s, and of course, we know what happened in 22. Now, just for your information, the first fascist town, I'm not using this word in a colloquial, in a pejorative manner, I'm using that in a descriptive manner. The first fascist town was created in what is today the Croatian Rijeka, Fiume. Fiume, it's near Trieste. And D'Annunzio was a friend, was a great poet and a great leader. I'm not lauding him, I'm not making eulogies about him. But he moved to Rijeka and they created their own state, the first fascist state in Squadristi. And he wrote, D'Annunzio was a great author, no question about, translated also into the English language, very good translation. So you may want to have a look at what he said. What was his perspective of the Quarnero, of this whole Bay Area? My mom comes from the island of Krk. She's of partly of Italian origins as well. So anyway, this is a different, entirely different ball game from the ball game going further down in the Balkans. You know? So this was in 1919. Then 22, you know what happened in Rome, March in Rome. And then 10 years later, another guy emerged on the map. It was the end of the Weimar Republic. This was the end of, we can say, liberal order, so to speak. And then again, neither Hitler, or for that matter, the new authorities in Germany, they were not particularly interested in dissolving Yugoslavia. So please try to remove that from your brain. Germany wanted to have a compact Yugoslavia, a strong monarchic Yugoslavia, which was actually help the German interest in further in the south, especially in the eastern Mediterranean, which was quite important for Germany in terms of resources and so on. But it was also important for the Brits, you know, the Creta and the eastern Mediterranean, Turkey, the Bosphorus, was has been since the 17th century of extreme
importance. Of course, parallel to this, we have the first Greek-Turkish War, which the Turks called the War of Liberation, which is the struggle over Western Anatolia, which was supposed to be given to Greece, including Constantinople. However, the Turks rally under Ataturk, and they managed to hold on to Western Anatolia and Eastern Thrace, which is near Adrianople, Odrin in the Macedonian language. So this is the Eastern Mediterranean is a hotbed of rivalries, Greek and Turkish, French and English, English and German. You have the dynasty of Muhammad Ali Pasha in Egypt. They are trying to do something of their own. They are chafing under British occupation slash tutelage. So Europe in the 1920s and 30s is a very interesting place, the entire Eastern Mediterranean. Do continue, Dr.
No, well, thanks for your little detour. We certainly, as I said, we would like to make it as simple and as didactic and as digestible for our listeners, especially for our students, as possible. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the period in the 20s and the 30s. Of course, Yugoslavia was just a matter of time before it collapsed. Meanwhile, of course, I forgot to tell you that the centerpiece, the main pillar of the first Yugoslavia was called Serbia, because the Serbs, for the ethnics, you know, I told you about the Serbs, they actually, Serbia had already been an independent entity. It was on good terms with France. Traditionally, even nowadays, the French language is much more spoken in Belgrade than in Zagreb, which is also quite indicative of the mindset of two different peoples. So basically, Serbia, although they made the relative majority of the first Yugoslav population, roughly 14 million people just prior to the outbreak of the Second World War, 40%, but they did not make an absolute majority. We can draw the parallel here, if you wish, with Belgium. Well, later on, we can talk a little bit about Belgium as well. And I will explain you why, for instance, even during the recent war in when Yugoslavia started to fall apart in 1991, we had lots of Flemish volunteers fighting on the Croatian side. Lots of, in fact, there were about 30 of them. There were lots of Poles, lots of Swedes also, Danes as well, and so on. So it was quite interesting. Even this historical profile of those animosities reflected itself 60 years later. So back to the 41, of course, there was a very strong nationalist movement, which was hardly a very anti-Serbian movement, very chauvinistic, we can also say. Let me just back up a little bit. I know, folks, when you talk about different ethnicities, it is unavoidable that your professors, your lecturers wallow in their subjectivity or their biasness or whatever. I'm trying to avoid it as much as I can. I will try to look at this situation in ex-Yugoslavia from the American perspective, and I will forget for a while my bias, my Croatian bias, or my roots, if you my gene pool from Croatia. So back to 40s, the Croatian nationalists, they had very powerful, they were extremely unhappy, many Croats, even intellectuals, with the situation in first Yugoslavia. They thought that this was primarily just the first Yugoslavia, the euphemism for greater Serbia. Mm-hmm. So please keep that in mind if you want to understand what happened in 91, in 92, in Yugoslavia, in Croatia, and later on this terrible war we had. So basically, then they organized themselves in the first terrorist, or you can say terrorist or freedom fighter. You know, someone's freedom fighter is always someone terrorist, and vice versa. So in the 20s, or late 20s, early 30s, the Croats, Croatian nationalists, organized themselves in Hungary, next door, further, it's about 100 miles from where I live, you know, near 100 miles the border, on the Admiral Horthy. You know, Hungary has traditionally been an ally of Croatia, because our royal roots go back to our Pacta Conventa, what we call it, from the 12th century, when Croatian aristocrats and vice versa, when they married into royalties of Hungary and so on and so forth. So by and large, even during the recent war in ex-Yugoslavia, there were quite a few Hungarian volunteers fighting for on the Croatian side. Of course, the Russians fought, quite a few Russians fought on the Serbian side. So please do keep that in mind, you know, because the devil is in the detail, as we always say, you know. So by and large, you know, this Croatian Ustašas, which mean Ustaša means to stand up, to rise up, they actually provided, you know, logistics. In fact, they killed the first king along with Macedonians and Bulgarians.
Yeah, this is one of the first instances of Macedonian Croatian cooperation. In 1934, Vlado Černozemski, he was a Macedonian revolutionary from the Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, helped by the Ustasha. They provided the logistics, and so did apparently Mussolini, because of geopolitical rivalries with Yugoslavia, to assassinate Aleksandar of Yugoslavia, the king of Yugoslavia at the time, in Marseille. There are many songs about it. We in Macedonia, they were banned during the communist period as well, because they stoke anti-Serbian sentiment or whatever. But yeah, this is one of the many instances of Macedonian-Croatian common struggle against imperialism.
Fraternity, we can say. It's very interesting. So just folks need to know, it's not just the religion, because usually folks argue nowadays, even modern academics or would-be academics. I know quite a few of them. I'm going to mention their name here in the States, who like to pontificate about Yugoslavia, this and that, and they often argue how the Serbs are Christian Orthodox as opposed to Croatian Catholics, who are radically very conservative. I come from a very conservative Catholic family. However, keep in mind, most Macedonians are Christian Orthodox as well. And of course, even prior to the First World War, we don't want to bother folks, and I'm sorry, but we need to tell that Serbs and Bulgarians were for a while in a war, you know. So do not assume that the religion is necessarily a cleavage of identity. So basically, let me just run real fast this whole issue of what happened. So yes, the Croatian terrorist movements, the freedom fighting movements, when the war broke out in 1941, of course, Yugoslavia literally disappeared from the map. The king fled. He went first to Egypt, and then he settled down in London, like most of those quote-unquote liberal governments who sought refuge in London, under the auspices, of course, you can imagine, of a cigar-smoking Churchill and whiskey-drinking Churchill as well, we can say. So anyway, so this memory of the Brits is not very well received, particularly not among Croats. We can come to that when I explain you later on what happened in 45. 45 was a disaster for the Croatian people, for our gene pool, I can put it quite bluntly, for my own gene pool in our family. So basically, Croatia was became, quote, an independent state, heavily allied to Germany, very friendly, and in fact, it actually lasted as the last ally, the best ally of the Third Reich until mid-May, was unlike Romania, unlike Hungary to some extent. Hungary was already taken over by the Soviets in January 41. And then, of course, in Slovakia and Czechia, you know, Beneš decrees, you know, actually sponsor the mass executions and, of course, the persecution of the Germans. And about 200,000 were killed in Vltava. You know, the Czechs like the music, so, you know. And I don't want to ridicule. I have good friends who are Czechs as well. But they did some horrible things to Germans in 44, 45 because of this big liberator Beneš decrees. Basically, the first ethnic cleansing was not started by Mladic or by Milosevic or by the Serbs. Actually, it started by a very quote-unquote liberal pro-Western Czech leader, Beneš. He actually sponsored that legally, that all Germans being downgraded and expelled from 2.5 million from Czechia. Anyway, let's go back to Yugoslavia, because look, folks, whatever I say here, it's so interrelated. I can talk here about the Croatia, for that matter. But just imagine that we are talking about your country the size of the Rhode Island. We're talking about the country 30,000 square miles. Macedonia is even smaller than that. Slovenia is 15,000 or 20,000 square miles, right next door, 5 miles from where I live. You know? So just imagine that the sense of a distance, sense of space is quite different than, let's say, a sense of space from somebody, from my friend in San Francisco, Greg Johnson. Well, Greg can sit in his behind his wheels, and he can drive to Tahoe Lake, and he can be back in a single day. But if you travel even to Klagenfurt for where I live, and it's in Austria, it's about 120 miles. Well, gee, you got to think about 1 week. It's a major journey. If you travel to Vienna, which is exactly 200 miles from where I live.
Didn't they open the tunnel, journey. The Karadake tunnel between Slovenia and Austria? I think it's a shorter trip now.
Yeah, well, but you got to go through this. Now they have this COVID regulations.
Ah, yes. Right.
So
right.
You have to show this. Well, I guess next time I'll turn myself into some Alibaba. I'll become an immigrant. You know? I'll just grow my beard and probably let my hair down, and I'll probably paint my face a little bit, tarnish my face, and I will not have to have a free pass. Like usually, if I travel to Slovenia, which is 5 miles where I live, I got to show a bunch of papers, you know, those certificates and what have you. All this is another hoax. I've seen so many hoaxes. Anyway, this in 1945, you know what the result was for Europe, and not just for the bad guys, but also for the good guys. So basically, I got to be a little bit, I don't want to sound too subjective. I know that the situation was disastrous in Macedonia. It was also disastrous in Albania, because the entire Eastern Europe, because of the deal struck between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, first in Tehran and then later on at Yalta, in the Soviet Union, actually divided us up. Actually brought us again into another Yugoslavia, this time under the auspices of communism. So add to those inter-ethnic troubles and misgivings between Serbs, Croats, and different European nations like Poles, Germans, Hungarians, Romanians, you name it. Add to that the communist imprint, then the situation gets very, very, very serious. Now, just in passing, I don't want to, later on we can discuss about some of the books, not necessarily mine, but I can refer you to some objective books on the disaster of the communist and the communist killing fields in 45. But basically, this was a disaster, especially the Croats, because you know, they were charged as a guilty nation, collaborationist nation, fascist nations. And as a kid, as a high school guy back in communist Yugoslavia, where I grew up, we had this stigma, this constant stigma. The minute I would define myself and define my self-identity as that I'm proud of being a Croat, I would be denounced, oh, you're a fascist Ustasha. So this was constantly shoved down our throat over and over again in my family and elsewhere. And so we just sort of, we had to learn the ropes. We had to play this homo duplex type of a personality, you know, to survive. Now,
that is eerily similar to what white children are now learning in the
West. Yes, we'll come
to
that in a second. I'll just finish with this gene pool. It was a disaster because our entire middle class was wiped out in Croatia. We lost about 200,000-300,000 people, you know, of course, soldiers, Ustasha, right-wingers, and so on. Some of their descendants, I know them well because I live with them in Argentina, Australia. There are quite a few of the United States. But they are now old-timers. One guy I know, he's a former Ustasha, he's 95 years. He lives in Toronto. He wrote me this morning. Another lady, their grandparents, they live in Argentina. There's a strong Croatian community. Basically, this is a community which, thanks to Perón, you know, Perón is also a legend. Now, there are certain legends, like Croats, like Maria Teresa, who was an Austrian lady, a queen, because she introduced some new legislation back in the 18th century, and she helped Croats quite a bit, like all other nations in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But Croats are particularly happy with Perón. Perón was the person who actually opened up his borders and allowed German refugees, collaborationist refugees, even French refugees from Vichy France, to flee and to get their citizenship and to establish themselves there. And we have quite a few, even now, it is in Croatia. I know people, second generation, are very high diplomats and who work in the Croatian, even the police, in the secret service, who were born in Argentina of their parents who had fled ex-communist Yugoslavia in the late 40s. I guess this is the end of the scenario. So what was this Yugoslavia all about? I'll give it to you if you have some sub-questions. I just want to make sure that I don't run too fast. I want to make sure that folks can relate to that. If there are some questions, please feel free to raise the question, or you can have our guests ask me the question. And then we'll come later on, of course, to 1991 and how, in fact, this Yugoslavia fell apart again. second time in a row.
Right. And as Tom has said, as Dr. Sunich has said, I'm sorry, Dr. Sunich has said, we are open to your questions, so you know where to find the entropy links. Our moderators have graciously provided that in the chat. We are also taking donations and questions on entropy, and I see that Slog and has donated 14 lemons. I wish someone could donate something to complete that conceptual hole. And of course, Gaudius Maximus has donated a diamond. This is the strange currency we use on DLive. It's a very immature platform, but I've grown to like it. I've grown to like DLive. It's a shame that, well, they are going to deplatform us one of these days, and we're going to all have to learn how to use Odyssey. And that would be all for the donations. Now, just let me refresh the entropy tab. Here's two. We have 200 euros from Hortator21. He asks, Europeans and their diaspora are diverse culturally and linguistically, but have much in common too. What are strengths and weaknesses you identify between European nations? We are suffering cultural rot and spiritual self-belief issues. How best do we combat our collective woes? And then he has a comment about nationalism. But first, I want to address his issue here about the linguistic and cultural diversity. And are there any strengths and weaknesses between the European nations? And how can we combat our collective woes? Have you any thoughts on that, Dr. Sunich?
Sure. Well, let me first tell you, I wrote about this quite extensively, so please have a look at my website or also at the Occidental Observer. And I'm trying to keep my creation emotions at the low level. Now, look, let's start with one advantage among white nationalists, or we can say nationalists in the United States of America, and also disadvantage. The advantage of white nationalists in the United States of America, my friends, if you would, my good colleagues, is that they are not so much obsessed with a historical memory. You know, the historical memory, which is a magic word nowadays, and everybody, and even high level, you know, academics use that word, historical memory, Geschichtsbewusstsein, la mémoire historique, and so on. But it can be something that's very troublesome. It can be, it can actually stop you. It can hinder you from making any further effort. I often think here about the Friedrich Nietzsche, who wrote about monumental history and archaic and antiquarian history. He was actually ridiculing even this whole concept of historical memory, which in many, many instances, particularly in the we have seen in the 20th century, is enabling, is sort of a castrating, we can say, excuse me, the word, European nations to come together. So again, I have some very high misgivings, some very big misgivings about the nationalisms in Europe of the first 20th century. And as I said at the beginning, I'm the last person to eulogize National Socialism, or for that matter, fascism, because just as much as fascism and nationalism was quite keen in detecting the pathology of communism, there's no question about that. There's some great scholars, authors, we can talk about them later on, especially if you're familiar with the German language. You can download many, many stuff from Völkischer Beobachter und das Reich. There was some top-notch, you know, academic pieces written in those journals during the NS Germany. However, we know very well how this Second World War ended. It was not just a war against communism and liberalism, it was also the internal civil war. Ernest Nolte, we can also mention this guy, great German historian. And this historical memory still carries its bad wounds, in a sense. And you can notice that even now, this, although to a much lower level between the Poles and Russians, you know, and of course you can notice that on the daily basis in the eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainian nationalists, good people, some of them are very fine, but so are the Russian nationalists. So you got to check out, or you've got to sound out both sides before you make your own executive decision as far as your scholarly or political work is concerned. The same thing goes to a lesser extent between the Romanians and Hungarians. Of course, there are some territorial disputes, let alone between Serbs and Croats, you know. And I got to be careful, even with my own hardcore nationalists here. I mean, I know lots of them. They know me here in Croatia. But if I can ask you a rhetorical question, do I need to build up my identity solely on my anti-Serbian feelings? Or for that matter, we can ask the same question, you know, the Flemish folks. And I got big friends among Flemings. Do they have to be anti-Walloons? Do they have to hate the French in order to establish or refurbish their Flemish identity? This is something quite difficult. I got to recap. This is quite difficult for our friends in the United States to understand. My friends,
I wouldn't say it's difficult because, well, at least the Z-Man who was the guest on last Writer's Block has pointed out that American blacks have a wholly negative identity. They define you're talking themselves.
Okay, I was coming to that. Let me just interrupt. Look, of course, my friends, my colleagues, let's say down in the Bay Area, or for that matter on the East Coast, folks I know of, the partly Irish, partly Flemish, partly Scandinavian, partly from Scotland and so on. So we don't make folks in America, this is the great advantage of the United States of America, at least they don't so much harp on this cultural memory under quotation marks. And basically, American nationalism, which I find quite positive, has been, be it implicitly or explicitly, we can explain later on that word, thanks to my friend Kevin McDonald, he wrote about this quite extensively. American nationalism has basically been, or rather, largely based on the issue of race. This is, of course, not explicitly said, and we'll come to that. We can talk about the Chinese Americans or Latino Americans, or we can talk to Jewish Americans. How do they define their identity as opposed to Gentile or white Americans? So these are very specific issues which we need to clarify very, very, very much in detail. Again, I consider that the big advantage of the early, if we can say, the first half of the 20th century United States, of not being so much burdened, of carrying this burden of this petty nationalism, which has been, which is still, and which has been eating, which has been devouring Croatian pan-national, we can say, European type of a striving or goal that we badly need. I don't feel very well at all when I see on the daily basis that there are some some intellectual disputes between the Polish intellectuals and Russian intellectuals, let alone when we saw a couple of years ago this crisis in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Ukraine. Of course, ask yourself a question. Or we can say the same thing. We can talk about the Serb-Croat conflict, you know. Just the other day, I had four prominent Serbs and intellectuals who came over and visited me a little bit, because I certainly don't want to let the communists, the former communists and liberals, discuss about quote-unquote brotherhood and unity or what diversity, of course, another word, diversity. We can talk about the communist lingo a little bit in communist Yugoslavia. I'm sure our friends in Britain, in the United States of America, I'd be very much surprised to find out how most of those words that they use now in higher education in the United States, in the UK, such as ethnic sensitivity, training, diversity, anti-fascism, we had exactly the same words in the communist legislation back in the 60s, 70s. So I grew up with that. We can talk about this. So there are lots of things I could tell you, I could convey as well. So once again, this is the positive side. It used to be a positive side of the US, but we now know what the demographic profile of the United States looks like. Now, am I going too far? Am I just bombarding folks with too many, many issues at once? Now, the negative side of the American nationalism, globally speaking, of course, there are some exceptions. There are some powerful folks like Greg Johnson, we can say, there are Kevin McDonald, there are highly literate folks, high academics, and there's no question about it. But by and large, the problem, the way I see it from my perspective of American white nationalism, is the lack of culture, of the cultural identity, because you cannot just create your nation or your identity on the basis of your haplotypes, or for that matter, your race. with all due respect, you know, I'm a great reader of Klaus and Günther as well. I read all of his books in German and others as well. And Konrad Lorenz as well, we can discuss about. I would like to give a lecture on Konrad Lorenz and other authors as well, in German possibly. So anyway, so basically I think that the Americans should probably give more value to this cultural factor, which is quite important. Again, we come to cultural memory. You just can't have a nation and race alone. You just have a certain sense of the tragic. I discussed with Richard Spencer that issue at one of my talks back in Washington, D.C. When was that? About 12 or 15 years ago when we met about 20 years back, or in Toronto. I forgot. So he's a very sharp fellow as well. So certain issues, of course, we disagreed. So actually, I told him about Richard and how important this is, not just the racial factor, but also you got to take into account this cultural memory. Of course, the Macedonians have their role models like Alexander the Great, of course, you know. So folks,
which can be a very mixed blessing, as I found out. Every Macedonian male lives in the shadow of Alexander the Great, and I will be 33 much sooner than I expected. And where is my empire? Where is my kingdom?
Right. What did it remain? You see, things go. We should reach Spengler again. You know, the decline of the West. This is the ongoing process. You know what crossed my mind? Sorry to make so many digressions. I'm sure you know Pyrrhus was a great Macedonian leader as well. He actually beat the Romans, when was that, two centuries before Christ, on several occasions. And he was a very, very gracious guy. He was he's not vindictive. He was a great warrior anyway. So, yes, we're just swallowed by history, I guess, this communism. And I would like to say a few words about that, if you don't mind. Communism was a disaster. It's a biological disaster with this egalitarian Gleichschaltung, and what you call it, this leveling, the pro-Christian leveling, which happened all over Eastern Europe and Yugoslavia. It was particularly bad because it had this ethnic component in it.
Yes, another thing I wanted to have it as a sort of response to Horator's question is that I too support white people uniting to protect our interests globally, really. I want not just on the European continent, but to understand that what has been come to known as the European diaspora, the settler countries, America, Canada, Australia, Argentina, you know, they have to, but we should avoid this Procrustean leveling down to white, because, see, that's the thing. This was already attempted in communist Yugoslavia. I was thinking about this. My father, I was born on the last day of communist Yugoslavia, 29th of November 1991, the last time this Day of the Republic, as it was called back then, was celebrated in Macedonia. And already the war was raging in Croatia. It was already done in Slovenia, and Macedonia had already had its independence referendum. But my father, he told me that basically the Yugoslav state, what it did was it tried to use universal conscription to foster camaraderie between the various so-called Yugoslav peoples, and basically to create this synthetic Yugoslav identity, which, synthetic though it may be, a lot of people still identify as quote-unquote Yugoslavs. They will call their primary language Serbo-Croatian, right, which is a synthetic constructed language which tries to split the difference between Serbian and Croatian. And I see in this attempt to create this, let's call it a sub-racial group identity, an identity for all Southern Slavs excepting Bulgarians, this Procrustean bed type leveling down or up to something we are fundamentally not. They're trying to make all six nations of Yugoslavia live up to a standard, it's not even a standard, it's an unworkable middle, an unreachable middle. They're trying to make us live like the average of these six nations, and there is no such thing as no human being, no nation fulfills the standard. Do you catch my drift, Dr. Sonic?
Sure, by all means. Well, listen, let's just make some conclusions as far as this portion of our discussion is concerned. The first thing we have to state quite clearly is that multiculturalism doesn't work. Often it appears in a very romantic garb, but it leads to disaster. You can see that now with the Mandelized South Africa as well. Now the bad guys, the white guys, you know, have been demonized over the last, and they are still being demonized in the U.S. media and CNN or whatever, New York Times, Washington Post. So we are the bad guys. We are white supremacists. It's another totalitarian verbal construct, or rather locution. We can discuss about that. I'd like to say words about it. Multiculturalism doesn't work. No. And of course, if you add to that the racial component, we'll come to that, then it can become very, very nasty. So I guess if I can just backpedal a little bit, if you allow me, just for 2 minutes, I guess we have to make a few critical statements as far as the first Yugoslavia is concerned, which was basically the international construct of France, the Third French Republic. You know, they kept Yugoslavia alive, the monarchic Yugoslavia. The second Yugoslavia, keep in mind, since Truman, Eisenhower, all the way down to Carter until 92. I know it firsthand because I was often in the State Department and we were lobbying back in the 80s. I was lobbying with Croatian immigrants for the dissolution of Yugoslavia and for the end of communism as well. I was quite active then, you know, side by side with other things that I was doing. So basically the answer of the State Department in Washington, D.C. was always, we want to preserve the integrity and unity of Yugoslavia. I got this in archives. You can find even on my website some of my correspondence with State Department officials. And just one last thing, which is quite important. We often accuse Milosevic of, you know, and Mladic, and they're just like demon figures in our talk about some negative guys. But keep in mind also that, I don't know exactly the date, June 21st, 1991, just a couple of months prior to when you were born. You were not born, just 91, just prior to the war, the break of war. James Baker, you know James Baker. Some younger folks may not know him, but older folks know James Baker, who was the chief of U.S. diplomacy. He was in Belgrade. Yugoslavia was still there, but on the brink of falling apart. And then he said to Milosevic, and not to Milosevic, to the Serbian presidency, Croatian presidency, he sort of put all those heads together, and of course the Yugoslav presidency was still nominally on there. He said, the United States, you can find it in New York Times, I don't want to misquote him, the United States will not endorse or will not accept or endorse the unilateral decision of Slovenia and Croatia to move out, to not bail out, but to move out, to indiscriminately, to unilaterally move out of Yugoslavia. What do we have next day, the day after? Well, the Yugoslav National Army, Serbian-controlled National Army, attacked Slovenia and Croatia. The war started. So basically, we can now argue about the State Department, all those diplomats, about neocons or whatever you want to call them. Now we can, one of these days, we can have a show on American foreign policy in the Middle East as well. This was part of my studies and part of the lectures I had back in the States as well. So basically, yes, the United States of America for 40 years kept the Yugoslavia intact on the map. Why? Of course, there were geopolitical reasons because of, you know, Yugoslavia was a non-aligned country, somewhat hostile to the Soviet Union, to Brezhnev, Andropov, and so on. So the United States, given its southern flank, NATO southern flank, Greece, of course, and Turkey, which is quite important, you know, Turkey has the largest NATO army, you know, 500,000 soldiers, you know, so it's a very important NATO members in Eastern Mediterranean, and of course in the southern Aegean Sea as well, which is Greece, is still a member of the NATO. So Yugoslavia was sort of a tampon. It was a sort of a buffer zone. It was a good place. So don't rock the boat, regardless of what the Yugoslav secret police is doing, killing people and imprisoning them. You know, Yugoslavia just prior to its breakup, had the largest number of prisoners of consciousness, including my old man. My old man was a lawyer. He was imprisoned for 4 years. He was adopted by several congressmen, but we'll talk about those private issues some other time. So anyway, be it as it may, Yugoslavia fell apart, but yes, to a large extent, the Western Europe, including the early European Union, which was launched just about the same time when Yugoslavia started falling apart, they were all adamant about preserving the multicultural Yugoslavia. Keep in mind, multicultural Yugoslavia was a role model for multicultural and multi-ethnic European Union. Now, take a wild guess, folks, so you don't have to be very visionary or you don't have to have four eyes in your head. Just look at the European Union, basically what it turned into, and I don't want to ridicule this whole issue, it turned into a big transfer union where the Germans have to pump up 40 billion euros every year in order to have countries like Greece and other Mickey Mouse countries, excuse my words, including, no, I don't want to say that Portugal and Spain are Mickey Mouse, but they are getting a big chunk of money.
Yes, we apologize to Mickey Mouse.
Yes, so Poland also, they got a big chunk of money from the German taxpayers, or Steuerbezahlers, they say. So a lot of things are not as easy as they are. So basically, yes, Croatia is now part of the European Union. But if you ask me, again, another paradox, in terms of its sovereignty, it's a magic word, sovereignty. Sovereignty, everybody talks about sovereignty and identity. These are magic words now in U.S. scholarship and, of course, EU scholarship. What a sovereignty means. Who defines sovereignty? Carl Schmitt very well said, wer definiert Souveränität? Who is in charge? Who defines this word? So basically, Croatia, I'll say that slowly, has less of sovereignty nowadays than before when it was part and parcel of Yugoslavia. What does that mean? For most of our laws, most of our legislations are teleguided, or for that matter, are being drafted in Strasbourg or in Brussels, even for minor things. I'm not talking about just fish and the size of tomatoes and the size of potatoes, you know. But basically, even if we decide to make a foreign policy move, we have to have a prior blessing from Brussels, from those commissars, and most of them don't even speak the Croatian language. Most of them don't even know what's going on here, let alone most of the folks, all of them in the commissars, 28 of them, they weren't elected, you know, in the democratic process. They were just imposed, you know. Just look at their pedigree, and most of them come from a left-leaning type of a perspective. Look at the pedigree of the chief commissar, the lady, German lady von Leyen. She was a former Minister of Defense in Bundesrepublik Germany. He screwed up the German army as well because they cut down the process of financing and subcontracting and so on. So she didn't do a good job, you know, other than losing 50 German soldiers in the Hundukush in Afghanistan. So they're mad at German veterans, are very angry at her. Now she's the big boss now. But of course, she also has to listen to somebody else and to someone else's music. And I guess that's the name of the game. If you're on somebody's stake, I don't want to philosophize, you got to listen to his music. If once upon a time it was Kissinger during the Cold War, he was the big shot, and he actually set the music for the American foreign policy. Then what we have back in the 90s and the early 20s, early 2000, of course, we know who runs the show in Washington, D.C. I guess, folks, you don't have to have a PhD to figure out it's not just Biden, or for them was not just Winston, but rather people behind him. Look at the neocons, look at their pedigree, look at what they wrote about, the PNAC, you know, PNAC, and what the new American century, all those big shots, you know, they played a very important role, even in during the Cold War, during the war here in ex-Yugoslavia. Of course, they sided up for a time when when they took their breath, they started supporting Croatia a little bit. They even opened up certain channels for certain details and for certain hardware back in the 1995, because they were not too happy with the Serbian. Of course, keep in mind, the Serbian Milosevic spoke very good English, and he had good ties with Kissinger and Armand Hammer back in the 70s. He was very much a pro-American type of a communist leader. Back in the mid-70s and early, was a young communist apparatchik, But then by early 90s, of course, when Croatia bailed out, Croatia first was not very well accepted by the quote-unquote international community. It's a stupid locution. What does international community mean? Of course, we know who is behind the international.
Well, there is a Straussian interpretation that international community is just a very nice word for the will of the Anglo-American Empire. So
yes,
that, I guess, right?
Well, it's not just under, it's there. It's different lobbies, different groups as well, different academic circles who are very well paid. Usually folks focus on Soros, but I just don't want to rehash his name over and over again. If it was only one Soros, that would be very well. He was quite active in 94 and 93 here during the war in Croatia. It was a fledgling country. We didn't know. I came here in 93, so I had a high position here in diplomacy for a while. And you know, we can talk also about that. It's no secret. But be it as it may, then of course the Americans fell out with Milosevic during the war because some of the crimes his troops had committed, especially in Bosnia and Herzegovina, just were too much for the international community to swallow. There are folks also in Langley and folks elsewhere who actually quit and who actually didn't want to, who resigned completely. So it was a big mess in the quote-unquote international community going on back in the early 90s. You may want to have a look at some of the pieces, including some of my pieces, some of my letters to the editor in Chicago Tribune, New York Times, back in 91, 92, 93, just prior to my arrival. We had also a meeting at the Freedom House. I was in 88, so the Americans knew in 88. I was there with Mate Milosevic, some big-time Croatian nationalist, people who were interested in dissolving Yugoslavia and creating something else instead. This was in 88. We were all invited by the Freedom House. You can all trace it on the website under my name. And then how it all ended, of course, then all of a sudden you have a big love affair between the United States, between the government of Clinton and Albanians. Of course, you know, someone's terrorist is someone's freedom fighter. Of course, they were the ones the Americans sponsored also the launching of the sovereign, we can say, state of Kosovo and so on, which is quite adjacent to Albania. Again, folks, I hope I'm not bothering you too much with all those details. I could give the whole semester, I could lecture about that. Be it as it may, well, there's the big, you know, of course, the second largest American military installation and camp is...
Bonstone. Yes. I'm like 30 minutes drive away from, because Skopje is very close to the border with Kosovo.
This is not to protect the human rights or diversity or LGBT parades in Macedonia. This is there because this is a very sensitive spot for American intelligence and American...
Foreign policy interests.
Foreign policy, as far as the Middle East is concerned, takes 1 hour, well, less than 20 minutes you can get there in American jet plane. You get to, well, in 20 minutes you're there. Aviano, these are all, you know, military installations over there. How this is going to look like, we can, of course, talk about this some other time or possibly even today. So what it happens, just let's keep in mind, I will just sum up, folks. As in terms of sovereignty, be it Croatia, be it Slovenia, or for that matter, even Macedonia, is to some extent even less sovereignty nowadays than back in communist Yugoslavia. Except, of course, we are not being beaten yet. We are not being, you don't see the gulag topography, although this may be the case. And one of the reasons I certainly would prefer you folks to come over here, it's still very much a homogeneous in terms of its ethnicities. It's simply much safer to jog downtown in Zagreb than, let's say, in San Francisco or in Sacramento or in southern LA where I lived, or for that matter in Washington, D.C. You don't want to do that. You don't want to go to some parts of New York at this moment. But here in Croatia, at this very same moment, it's a little bit lousy weather. It's not very nice. But you can take your lady out. You can take a walk and You won't have any problems whatsoever. Plus, you will look at the phenotypes, which are more or less correspondent to your phenotypes, if you see what I'm getting at, okay? So you'll be looking at faces which are not very exotic, but very normal and very European-like.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mrs. Jilvi loves Croatia. Of course, I love Croatia myself. She has suggested that we move there because the government of Macedonia doesn't exactly appreciate my intellectual labors. And of course, our Albanian neighbors don't appreciate them either. But I said to her, you know, why would I want to move to Zagreb? It's Skopje, but colder. Now, if I'm going to move to Croatia, I'm going to live in a place like Makarska, somewhere on the coast, somewhere I can run a beach bar and basically not work. I have very strong Mediterranean work ethic. But Dr. Sunic is here to answer your questions. And the questions, there have been many questions about us. Hold on a second. Let me just find this. Defined on over in the Odyssey chat asks a very interesting question. What does Dr. Sunic think of Rebecca West's book about Yugoslavia, Black Lamb and Gray Falcon? Dr. Sunic, are you familiar with this book?
Yes, I think I was. I was just trying to refresh my memory a little bit. The last name, was it Rebecca Vaughan or what was the last name?
Rebecca West.
Rebecca West. I guess West. I remember. I'm even quoting
with the W. I'm sorry. Place.
It let me just take a wild guess, but it's not a wild. She was very much leftist oriented British author, and mm-hmm. She was not, of course, a big sponsor of the Croatian independence. To my knowledge, I don't think I read this book, but I'm familiar with the title. Again, please do apologize because I don't want to misquote something that I haven't read. Mm-hmm. I usually quote authors that I read. Evelyn Vaughan, I guess, was it the gentleman
who wrote Rebecca
quite
West.
Positively about Croatia? Now, I've been traditionally very suspicious of British scholarship in the 50s, 60s, and later on, because it was very biased. It was very pro-British, we can say, very pro-liberal in a sense. And I would have preferred the German scholars of that time. That's the reason, folks, I'm always insisting, read the German language, because the Germans, and you notice that, I'm sorry, I don't want to I just don't want to slide away from our main topic. But even if you follow the newspapers, for instance, the New York Times in the 60s, 70s, or for that matter, the Washington Post, on the one hand, and Die Welt and the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung in Germany, their narrative about the Yugoslav, you know, some crisis and so on, and even when the war started, was very often quite different mm-hmm. and quite apart, let alone the French, of course. You know, I've got to look at the pedigree of the author, of the correspondent. Most of them were of Serbian origin. Paul Jankovic was another guy, and the other guy, I forgot the name. So, of course, they were a certain way biased towards Serbs, or towards one side as opposed to the other, you know. So mm-hmm. again, Rebecca West, yes, now I remember, it will come to my mind. Have a look at my book, Against Democracy and Equality, was my master thesis. But please do have a look at my, I would say, quite a scholarly piece, Woodrow Wilson's Defeat in Yugoslavia. I published that in a libertarian journal von Mises. I'm sure you're familiar with von Mises. It was a very scholarly piece where my major point is, well, you can download that, Woodrow Wilson's Defeat in Yugoslavia, the End of Multicultural Utopia. It's a heavily footnoted piece where I'm also quoting some authors. Please do, I can't keep a track of all those names and all those authors.
It is very easily found. It's also available for free, fortunately. I have relied heavily on this piece when I wrote my own. It's not really scholarly; it's more like a polemic piece about the Yugoslav meltdown. And you know, people have mentioned while I was promoting the show that Keith Woods did a video about the breakup of Yugoslavia. He blamed it on counterintelligence activity on part of the American state. And of course, I refuted his claims in my own piece on the Yugoslav breakup, which is called Nations, Not Projects. You can find it on Keith Woods and, of course, Dr. Sunish's work. Woodrow Wilson's defeat is heavily quoted in that piece. If our moderators would kindly look those two up and put them in the chat. So I guess we can segue this into the comparisons with the American situation now. As we said, the root cause of Yugoslavia's collapse was not just communism. It wasn't just ideological. It is because it is irrational to expect that six nations share a destiny, share a geopolitical orientation, share a cultural orientation, which was nevertheless forced upon us. And yet something even more ambitious is being attempted here with the European Union. And in our increasingly globalized world, it is being also attempted, you know, on a global scale. And in America, where while they do not have historic multiple nations in America, aside from, you know, some theories such as elucidated in Albion Seed or American nations, they are now importing the whole world. All of the nations are gathering in America in a very biblical scene, very Babylonian appearing. So can we follow, can we expect that the American state follow the fate of the Yugoslav state? Of course, it's not going to be a one-to-one correspondence, but can we, as veterans of the Yugoslav collapse, teach our American friends and allies something? What should they expect? Can they somehow benefit from what is apparently inevitable?
It's a good point. And let's again put things in a wider historical perspective. Why not start with the American, should I call it Civil War or the War of Secession? I myself, by my temperament, tend to be somewhat more sympathetic to Southerners. I have some very good friends here, James Edwards, and from the South. And every time I travel there, I feel a certain, you know, certain joy because, you know, ironically, despite the fact that America was, after its declaration of independence, sort of a split out from this European thought, it retained nonetheless certain traditional values, particularly the South, which were actually swept away and which were downgraded or simply killed after the French Revolution. So ironically, some of those nice mores and respect, you know, for your elders and traditional values and bonds and kinship, well, it's no longer the case in the South, but it's still some enclaves you can find, which certainly makes your life very pleasant and very joyous. Now, of course, we can, as I said, this Civil War has different perspectives, and it depends what you read. Again, I myself, again, I don't want to pester you folks with too many names and start with name dropping. I was quite influenced by Samuel Fitzhugh. I quote him quite often in my book,
Home on America. You mean George Fitzhugh?
George Fitzhugh. I mean, he was really very inspiring, more so than Orwell. He wrote his book, you know, 100 years before Orwell in 86, 87. He was a Southerner, a great scholar, was fluent in Latin as well and very readable. And he actually talked about this egalitarian steamroller and this mercantile type of a mindset which coming from the East. And of course, he ridiculed Jefferson and founding fathers and so on and so forth. A very peculiar type of a style, you know. So anyway, look, be it as it may, we can now make fun of the Serbs, Croats. We can, of course, with a certain sense of inferiority, we all Europeans have vis-a-vis white Americans and WASPs, especially towards WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. There is a certain sense of inferiority, which was, of course, imposed upon us after the Second World War, either with bad Germans, bad Ustashas, bad Nazis. All those words were tossed around. So it got to you after a while, this brainwashing period. You know what the Allied did, you know, and the English, what the Americans did with the brainwashing of the German people, and not just the German people, just with the erasure of 40,000, more than 40,000 titles of books that were removed from bookshelves and from libraries, from those that remained intact, because so many, I could probably give you the exact number of how many churches and libraries were destroyed by B-26, also by American bombers and how many civilians perished. And unfortunately, people don't learn that in high schools in the United States. Well, if they do, then they do that in a passing manner, but they don't probably realize that 85 cities in Germany were totally destroyed, total, 25 partially, and so on and so on. Anyway, we're talking about the United States of America. Let's start with the Civil War. It was an ugly war. The first, we can say, a total war. You know, they said, look what happened in Georgia, Atlanta. Look what happened in southern parts with this quote-unquote reconstruction. It was the first brainwashing. Actually started with the North, with carpetbaggers. And again, we have seen movies, we can see on. And I do always, I mean, I always sympathize with the losing side, even if the losing side is maybe negative. For that matter, I must say, I was not happy when the American bombers and English bombers started bombing across. They were flying over Croatia then, when they were bombing Serbia. And of course, this was, they did it against the will of Franjo Tuđman, you know, firsthand. I mean, I visited the man. He was.
Yes, they also violated Macedonian absolutely. Airspace in 1999.
So basically, it was the.
They bullied our prime minister into basically, but he held out. He did not allow for NATO troops to stage an invasion of Serbia from Macedonia.
Absolutely.
Land.
Absolutely, right. I fully agree with you. And folks do not know all the details. Unfortunately, there were people also working behind the back of Franjo Tuđman. He was dying next year. In fact, a couple of months later, he passed away. Had he not passed away, he would have probably ended up like Milosevic in The Hague. Anyway, I'm just giving
you... Tuđman has been dying since the 70s, so also, right?
This guy was blessing in disguise, you know. Yeah. So anyway, to make the story short, yes... you asked me about the United States. Of course, we can draw many, many parallels here. And of course, I mentioned a couple of details about the lingo, the language now used. Just study a little bit the lingo of some major outlets like what they call fake news, CNN or Washington Post. Just study a little bit the locutions they use. Like I mentioned some of those, like ethnic sensitivity, then diversity, which are very abstract words. And, you know, I don't like those abstract words because they remind me of ex-communist Yugoslavia, every single detail. When I was a kid back in, did I mention that already? I just want to rehash and recap myself. Even birth certificates in the 60s when I was a schoolboy were issued, and there was right at the bottom of the page, there was a Smrt fascizmu, sloboda narodu, death to fascism and freedom to the people. So anti-fascism was part of the negative identity, rather positive identity from the viewpoint of the communist government. And now we have the resurgence of anti-fascism in the United States of America. This is just like a bad reenactment. All let's say the West Coast, or particularly at Berkeley University, oh, Jesus, the ugliest place in the world. Or for that matter, in up north, Seattle, all those thugs, literally thugs or criminals, are doing, burning down the buildings and so on. You know, this reminds me like a bad reenactment, bad violent reenactment of what we went through in 46, 47, what my parents went through, you know, the confiscation, killings, mass killings, and so on. So, folks, I wonder what type of administration. Anyway, I don't want to voice my private opinion about this this particular administration and about the elections in which Biden won and how these elections were orchestrated. I mean, it was all predictable in 1916 when Trump was impeached. I used to be a big fan of Trump. There's no question about that. Because he had guts and had balls to say certain things. He actually called, he used the word fake news, and we actually knew what fake word news were in communist Yugoslavia. You wouldn't read the main news. You were reading behind the lines. You wouldn't read to Double Talk. Double Talk, we knew, we were like split personalities. We were outside in communist Yugoslavia in high school. I was playing games, you know, showing, you know, brotherhood, unity, singing all those stupid multicultural slogans. But back home, you know, we're cracking jokes about communists. We're joking about their phenotypes by their eyes. So, I mean, I was a city boy. I mean, we went to the choir and we went to the church not to pray God. So I went there to make jokes about communists and put graffiti on the wall.
There is a communist phenotype. You can always tell. You can always tell.
Of course, we knew that. And you know, that's why the reason I can tell that this thing in Orlando, I'm sorry, in Portland, or for that matter in Seattle or Eugene, you can tell though. I mean, I could tell that right away. Even in Washington, even when I watched a State Department official, I could tell right away what his pedigree is. Now, of course, we come to the most difficult portion. America is, well, it's past tense. Sorry to say that. Over the last 30 years, when I was there, well, there were 85% of people were of European ancestry. Now there's, I'm very skeptical. I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm not going to now cater to some of my whites. In fact, I must say, most problems I've had so far, most people who hurt me most are my own whites. I've had mostly problems with my own Croats, not with Serbs for that matter, or for that matter with blacks or Jews or whatever you want to mention. But
well, we have an expression in Macedonian, the stone comes from close up, right?
Yeah, close up, so. Exactly. So basically, look, I don't have any imaginaire, but I'm just saying the obvious thing. Multiculturalism doesn't work, folks. If you are filing for divorce, if you live in a lousy marriage, don't fake. Don't fake sex or don't fake orgasm, whatever. Just divorce, split up. It's better to bail out than to stay in a lousy marriage. It doesn't work. Fences make good friends. Even those fences, they may look alike, they can be within the same family, but I keep saying over and over again, just stay on your own. Stay in it. Be an Einzelgänger. I prefer solitude than faking friendship. What killed, what actually soured the relationship between Serbs and Croats was this bad memory, the bad historiography. Yes, this is important, which was actually served and dished out by communist historiographers, historians. Mm-hmm. They were constantly telling us how Croats were bad guys, Ustashis, born Ustashis, genetically spoiled already. So I grew up with this complex of inferiority. It had to explode. And this whole historiography just fell apart in 91. And I hope this is not going to be the case in the United States of America. But who knows? I'm not going to take wild guesses now. But I realize the fact that the situation is not good. Just witness the recent event in with this guy, what was this black fellow with the Rastafari look, you know, who was apprehended. I'm sure you read the titles, and we know that back in Eastern Europe, you read the title, it was not called, and we know very well, had it been committed, this crime, had it been perpetrated by a white guy, you would have on CNN, you would have in Washington Post, a white supremacist commits a mass slaughter, commits a Holocaust against blacks and so on. But now this was a black fellow, you know, and you had a mildish sort of a childish type of a euphemistic title like a black guy created an accident or whatever, an accident, so. Again,
they did not even mention his race. They whitened his skin on the photographs.
It was a half breed or something. And so what I'm suggesting here as a professor to folks, stay away from these guilt feelings. I wrote about this quite very extensive pieces for Occidental Observer, for UNS Review as well, and also in German. Very extensive, I would say, almost scholarly pieces that doesn't work. So I guess we got to get rid of this guilt feelings, this feelings of ethnic masochism, that this you constantly have to apologize, that you got to make disclaimers. This is something very bad. And of course, I understand the young folks, even if folks of your age, they want to preserve, or they want to, you know, they want to get paid, they want to survive. And just like in communist Yugoslavia, after a while, if it lasts for a long period of time, people join the communist party, or they became loudspeakers of the Communist Party because they want to preserve their petty perks. It's hard to be a fighter, you know. I can tell you about my whole family and how difficult it was for me, but I'm not going to talk about myself. You can find everything about me if you wish. I got nothing to hide. But to preserve your integrity, your intellectual integrity, I know it firsthand in the U.S. academia, which is worse, I got to tell you, which is probably the worst place in the world now. It's controlled by Antifas, semi-intellectuals. You can't even talk about Shakespeare, let alone about Ernst Jünger or Carl Schmitt, you know. Some places, even some military academy. Look, I mean, I repeated that several times. I don't want to go into that. In 91, 92, I was teaching at Long Beach, Cal State Long Beach. Then later on in Pennsylvania, there was a different colleges as well, at Juniata in Huntington as well. And literally, well, in California, it was really bad because I had 20% of my, no, it must be 50% of non-European Americans sitting in my class. So imagine I was teaching a course on Eastern Europe and, of course, on philosophy and literature. It was a very lively class, but look, folks, you know what the cognitive issue is, you know, conceptualization. I mean, we know the obvious thing. We can talk now about IQ. Great man, Richard Lynn. He visited me in Zagreb here with his wife, great man, Richard Lynn. You know about IQ, and we can spend an hour now talking about IQs. My good folks, my black folks, great folks, my students, but they had difficulties in conceptualizing certain things. And then when you start going, and then, of course, the white fellows, you know, they were yawning, they were sleeping, and, of course, some of them were damn lazy first in the first place, so they didn't bother, you know, learning. But it just, you can't, it doesn't work. The American education is the basket case. And it's not better in Europe, I can tell you, because the standards are being lowered, the intelligent people are being discarded or they're being simply pushed away. And again, we have this Procrustean bed, the neo-communist, paleo-communist bed now coming to the surface of the United States of America, also on the political level. Now, let me just make it clear. I'm not specifically using the word communism. America is officially not a communist country. But the mindset, or rather the narrative, that's a new word, narrative, is becoming very, very much pro-communistic. And in many instances, not just in academia, academia is a lost case, but also in a government, many government places, it's just, I'm not very optimistic.
It has even penetrated in and has been pointed out, for example, by Joel Davis, who has been on this show before to discuss this specific thing, that they're now basically trying to pass off the classic class struggle off as conservatism and right-wingerism.
The
degree to which communist and Marxist, specifically Marxist-style discourse, has penetrated into not just the cultural Marxism, but also classic Marxism. And as you have mentioned on the interview with Frodi Midjord, communist anthropology has penetrated into the Western mind. And for people who are not subscribed to Frodi Midjord's Culture Lodge, he calls it the cult, I think, donate to Frodi on... I think it's Gumroad. Yeah, I think it's Gumroad. And you will be able to access exclusive content, including through this interview with Dr. Tomislav Sunic on very similar subjects as today. So I can agree. I mean, people say, oh, it's just old boomer conservatives who say this is communism. But it is true in a deeper sense. These the enemies are not maybe Marxist-Leninists, but they have a communist type anthropology and they have a Marxist or Kultur-Marxist style discourse.
Exactly. That's the whole point. So look at folks, this is a good point. As an anthropology, communism as anthropology is alive and kicking. And again, I could refer you to many, many books and I've written extensively about this. It's not just that I'm rehashing my own thoughts and pushing my views, but I'm basically always quoting my every paragraph of mine. So again, Solzhenitsyn wrote about this, but Zinoviev probably captured this this mindset best. And of course, Bukowski did a good job. And then, of course, you had, you know, the guy of course often is quoted, the American often author. It will come to my mind. Just a second. I can't this very same moment. It was a very good. It was also very fluent in several European languages, pure born American. He passed away about 20 years or 30 years ago. It will come to my mind. But anyway, be it as it may, of course, we have the factor here of non-European migrations. And I guess this is something which we have been spared of so far. Eastern Europe, folks, ironically, is much more European, including Macedonia, including Croatia, very enclave, very white enclave, 100%. Please do come over. You can settle down here. I know friends, the American, half Americans married here who live here. So do come over, folks, and for the time being. It's a very nice place. It's very safe and so on. But basically, the entire Eastern Europe is more European than Western Europe. You go to Heathrow now, of course, you go to any place. Look, the first thing that literally, you know, feels a little bit strange, a little bit surreal is that you got to show your paperwork and you've got a passports to a British custom official or policeman. who has a turban on his head, who probably has a who is a Indian or Pakistani ancestry, right. And then you get interviewed by folks who are, and you sometimes wonder how do they conceptualize themselves and the other, me, for instance. So the communication, well, my answer is very simple. As long as those countries can serve as nanny states, or what's the right word, as welfare states, as long as there is money in a pipeline, those countries will be live and kicking. But once the money runs out, guys, be prepared for something, you know, ex Yugoslavia will be far worse than that. So when push comes to shove, look, folks, I realized that. Let me give you a psychological insight. Back in 93, when I came back with my wife here, I joined the Foreign Service here. I was quite often on TV in Croatia. I was giving interviews for different outlets in French, German, and English. They were all around here, crawling, you know, from different agencies as well. And I remember living, working literally with people who just a couple of years earlier, were ardent communists in Yugoslavia, who had actually put my old man in jail. You know? Of course, they were all very tense. They didn't know how the war is going to turn out, because we had very radical veterans also, you know, hardcore nationalists also, who didn't want to deal with the official Croatian army, but who had different methods. And anyway, so you can take a while ago, especially there were quite a few foreign volunteers, about 500,000 of them. I knew quite a few of them. Also, there was a couple of Americans, ex-Rangers, not necessarily of Croatian descent. So they didn't quite get along very well during the war with locals, you know, because the locals, they were also suspected of having collaborated earlier with the communist authorities. So there were splits, but it turned out well. It was a miracle. Of course, by the way, I also got to add that, you know, Tudjman was not very much respected in the West until even when Croatia was in May or in April 92, when it was acknowledged, when it was accepted as when it was recognized as an international unit, as a sovereign country. In 93, just prior to my arrival, I was there. Tudjman was in Washington, D.C., was May or April. Please apologize me. You may want to check in New York Times. Very important issue, very important. So the war was going on, 93, was blasting, you know, not here in Zagreb, but the hinterland, you know. It was like a very surreal situation. Here in Zagreb, it was all fun, people having nonstop light shows, smoking dope, joints and whatever, and just 20 miles further south towards Bosnia and Herzegovina, fighting each other, excuse my words, killing each other was really bad, you know.
This was the Macedonian conflict in 2001, was very similar to this.
Let me just, because it's right on the tip of my tongue, I shouldn't forget that. In 93, I was just about to leave the States and come here. I met Tudjman there. I mean, it was a long story anyway. It was in Washington, D.C. at the commemoration of the Holocaust Denkmal, the Holocaust statue monument. Very important event for all of us. We could talk about this as our supra identity, how important it is for not just for U.S. congressmen, but for that matter, European politicians and Croatian politicians to travel first to Tel Aviv before they made the stopover in Washington, D.C. or in Strasbourg. First, you got to travel to Tel Aviv and do your own pilgrimage over there. So actually, Tudjman was invited by Clinton, yes. I was in 23rd of, please, April, check on that. And you know what said next day? It was a big title in the New York Times. I'm going to paraphrase that, so please do apologize my paraphrasing, but it's along these lines. Croatian, Franjo Tudjman, Croatian president denies the Holocaust and argues that there were not 6 million but 600,000 people killed. This was the major blowback. This was the killer for the Croatian. He was not a diplomat.
He was a revisionist historian, wasn't he?
He was a revisionist, top-notch revisionist historian, but very bad, very poor sense of empathy, very poor. He never smiled, he actually.
Think Dr. Tudjman was autistic, possibly?
Yeah, it was a very strange. He lacked this verve. He lacked this stamina. he lacked this. I'll tell you. I'll choose the better word in English. He lacked this veneer. Okay, good word. He lacked this veneer, and Milosevic was far better. Milosevic spoke the English very well, formulated his language.
Yeah, but Milosevic, he was a banker, right?
He was a banker. I said earlier, prior to he was an American man in the mid-70s in the United States of America. Later on, he became a demon, and they started demonizing him. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to Tudjman was intelligent, very shrewd guy. He actually worked, and he was not vindictive at all. Actually, his advisors, his people in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, like Granich and other guys, Granich was my boss. He was a former medic of the former communist cutthroats, and all those names and so on. These were all part of the members. You know, he was surrounded by ex-communists. It was basically the war, ladies and gentlemen, orchestrated by Yugoslav Serbian Communist Party against the Croatian Communist Party. And of course, we're naive, and of course, diaspora Croats, immigrant Croats, we're all naive. We thought that this was not going to be the war of defense as it is officially now formulated in our legislation. We thought that this was going to be a war of liberation, fighting against communism first and foremost. Unfortunately, it didn't turn that way. That's why many of my friends, also foreign volunteers from the States, from Canada, also Sweden, and quite a few of them, Denmark, England as well, Britain. And that's why we got also disappointed, including the Croatian diaspora, including the Croatian expatriates. There are lots of them that are now literally pissed. They are literally thinking, what is going on? We have now the reenactment of new Yugoslavia, let's call it Yugoslavia, where sons and daughters of persons, of people who persecuted us, now, of course, under the auspices of liberal mystique, are now in the free marketeers, whatever, down there selling us ex-new Yugoslavia, of course, in different shape. So do not assume that Croatian nationalists, at least those that I am familiar with, are very much adamant about they're very much in favor of the present Croatia, which is basically, we can say, a servile state and must dance as the Brussels bureaucrats dictate. I don't want to stray away from the topic. I guess was this the answer to the question? I presume there might be a little bit of some people who might have some further questions. And if I get too epic, you may want to interrupt me and. Oh.
Okay.
Like we have a brief answer if possible.
We have a donation from ABC again on Entropy for $10. Oh, and my mistake. Hortator donated €200, not $200. So that's more money. Sorry about that. But ABC says for $10, nationalism has its role for a white man living in the land of his ancestors for hundreds of years. For the European diaspora, it is different. White identity has priority. Otherwise, the non-whites brought here by Jews or gangs with quote-unquote churchy names will seed hate among us and destroy us all. Right. I think he wants us to know whether we agree with that statement. Personally, I think you listen to Dr. Sunic, and nationalism has its problems also in the ancestral lands of Europe. I mean, it causes inter-European friction where energies would be better put towards fighting common foes. But we cannot forget our past. We cannot forget our ancestors either. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Sunic?
Well, yes, I guess the gentleman also touched on this Jewish question. So we may discuss about that. I have some disagreement with some of my nationalist colleagues about the Jewish question. We can discuss some other time about this. Now, the answer, let's first start with the migrations. Of course, this is a big, big problem now for all of us, because I'm very, very not pessimistic. It won't work. You know, at this stage, of course, the European Union has about 400,000 inhabitants. Out of those 400,000, you got 14 million people of non-European ancestry scattered in France, about 10 to 15 million, then the UK, I mean, all major cities. So again, sooner or later, this may, I'm not saying will, but this is not wishful thinking on my part, but it won't work. It certainly won't work. But before we start attacking and before we start deriding and making fun of Arabs or Muslims or blacks or whatever you want to call them. I don't want to blame those people. I don't blame those people at all. Let's look at the core issue. Who is responsible for this? Well, look, folks, let's just say openly, and this is where I disagree with many, many, many nationalists, both here.
You can speak openly here on Odyssey and DLive. We have not yet faced censorship, so speak as freely.
No. I'll tell you quite frankly where the problem is. The problem is in capitalism. Let's just call people by. Let's just call it by name. How can you be against the blacks, or for that matter, Mexicans, and yet at the same time be a preacher of free market? Look, I talked quite openly with Christian nationalists on the coast. They have beautiful, beautiful hotels, they have beautiful restaurants. But look, when push comes to shove, they'll certainly hire an Albanian guy or a Macedonian guy, or for that matter, a Turkish fellow or a woman from Romania or from Moldavia, because they're much cheaper. They're not going to hire a Croatian guy because a Croatian guy is too demanding. He's got bigger appetites. He wants to have a social security. He wants to have this and that.
Right.
Now, try to transplant that. I got friends in Fresno, Croat Americans, the big vineyards. You know, the Croats are good winemakers. So you go to Fresno, go to some places, those big-time Croats, you know, they have big crosses, with all due respect, big white nationalists. But when push comes to shove, they prefer to have cheap labor coming from some cholos, from some people from South LA, because it's not just a cheap labor. They're good people. They're Christians, of course. You know, we can discuss about this issue. It's a very sensitive issue. Mm. It's not Islam. I don't care about what you preach and what you pray with the gospel or Jehovah's Witness, or if you're a dog worshiper. What I am concerned with is our gene pool. Our gene pool is disappearing. And to a large extent, capitalism is responsible for it. Why? Because it destroys all borders. If push comes to shove, I'll try to be as frank as possible. If somebody offers me now for my house here, let's say $300,000, US dollars, whatever, I would. And if this guy happens to be from Syria and Iraq, there are fortunately none for the time being, then of course, after much weighing in, weighing out, I might accept his offer. Capitalism, or let's call it liberalism, it's a steam machine. It's worse than communism. It actually destroys all roots. Even Marx said that, you know. But you don't have to read Marx. You may want to read Proudhon and Bakunin and so on.
There is a old Hegelian interpretation of Marx which sees him as a reactionary against capitalism. I don't put much stock in it because the praxis of Marxism has been very different. But, you know, that's something to think about. You are completely right. And, you know, Skopje is completely plastered with these posters advertising for, you know, work in Zagreb as a driver, as a van driver, as a taxi driver. And I'm thinking, don't they have white guys who can drive in Zagreb?
Yeah. Well, yes, we all spoil rotten. You know, this is where we have to start, including myself. We all spoil rotten. First, we have to fight, real briefly, against three major evils. And this is the ideology of progress. And the second is the ideology of equality, of egalitarianism. And thirdly is this, you know, la-la land, you know, this imaginary la-la land which can be sucked out of some Hollywood movie and so on. Most folks here in Croatia, I know, especially now in this autistic COVID age we live in, they sort of draw their inspirations from those soap operas. They have them 24 hours. They all come from Hollywood, you know, on TV. And they literally, there are many, many young Croats, intelligent Croats, they think this is the way it is. They don't understand what South LA looks like. They don't understand that you got to pay your taxes. They don't understand that you get your car on lease. They don't still understand me. I've been here for 25 years. You know, they just cannot imagine that I don't drive a better car. I live quite modestly anyway. So let me just put another view. But other than that, and I wrote about this extensively, this is why, unfortunately, I create some enemies. Well, look at the church. Look at the Archbishop Conference in the UK or in the United States. You know who is now the chief guy in the Catholic hierarchy in the United States. He's not even a white guy. I think he's a black fellow. Look at the archbishops in Germany. It's just a disaster. They're totally, you know, they're the ones, including the Pope himself. Pope himself. He actually prostrates himself. He kisses the cans and toes. Of blacks, of Hispanics. He is the one who actually enables, he's the enabler of this multicultural society. So why should we now waste our time talking about the multiracial environment, let's say in Frankfurt or in Zurich, or for that matter in Berlin, Kreuzberg, you know, it's a dangerous area, no-go area, about clans. Now, the German police have problems with clans, with Lebanese clans, because they're dope dealers and so on. But who is actually the sponsor? You can't keep forgetting, folks. Please, I'm sorry. I don't want to hurt your feelings. I know today is Sunday. Most of you went to church. But by and large, not all, but most of Catholic clergy is officially the sponsor of multicultural, multiracial idea. We had that in Paraguay in the 18th century. We had it in Mexico, and of course, and now we have it in Europe. And I guess it's certainly not going to yield some positive results. And of course, I got to be careful. Of course, I have some friends. You know, I come from a very Catholic family, by the way, and Dominicans and some. Dominicans are good, and they still have a pretty strong racial. Not all of them, but some of them that I know of, and also
just to ask you a question: Croatia is a Catholic, a very Catholic country.
Very, actually. More than Poland, you know. It's part of our identity, in a sense.
What is the mood among the laity and the ordinary priests and the parish priests? I would say, are they following the Vatican in this multicultural, multiracial?
Good point. They are quite. They don't say it racially conscious, but they are quite conscious of their genes. They don't use the word genes, but they are very much aware of their ties. Mm-hmm. And of course, these, I'm talking about lower clergy, which are quite sympathetic. Yes. They are nice folks, more or less. But the higher you go up the echelons, and of course, the church, even the government doesn't want to rock the boat. It gives them quite a bit of money. They get 1 billion kunas. They get about, I'll tell you exactly, 200, well, for Croatia,
divide by seven to get euros, right?
They got quite a bit of money in government allowances and so on. And of course, the higher clergy, even now, I once served as his interpreter when I was posted in London as a diplomat, Cardinal Bozanić. He's a guy who comes also from the same island as my grandparents, from the island of Krk. Had a problem with his speech, but very sharp fellow, very sharp fellow. And of course, they have their intrigues and so on. You know, I myself and my family, you know, I'm not very much of a, I'm not going to talk about my views and so on, because sometimes I don't fit into any category. But he also has to listen to the ukas, as we can say, or to homilies of his chiefs in the Vatican, you know. So that's the way it is. If the Pope himself, who is in Argentina, he was come from Argentina. Imagine even the present Pope in Argentina speaks very good Italian, but with a Spanish accent. He's of Italian ancestry, and he was very much associated with Croatian priests, cross, especially during Peron. They had some very high, you know, Peron, his bodyguards and his doctors were all Croats. Anyway, it's a long story. So he actually knew quite a few of Croats over there. And Croats, they have their institute called Saint Jerome. What is the right word in English? And they have a big library over there. Good people, very intelligent. Of course, then I can just speculate, but there are quite a bit of disputes even in the Christian Catholic hierarchy here in Croatia, although it's not being displayed on public display. But again, as far as their institutional view is concerned, possibly also theological, they're all, you know, the church hierarchy is strongly in favor of foreign non-European migration, including the Muslim migration. It's in terms of ecumenism, in terms of ecumenical type of behavior, this is quite in line with the church epistles. You know, if you read St. Paul and his epistles to, and I mentioned that on several occasions, you know, so don't just blame the Antifas and don't just make fun of them. Don't just blame the Jews. You know, why should I blame the Jews? You know, because even, you know, I consider that even anti-Semitism, I said that on several occasions, as a form of neurosis, you know. Mm-hmm. Even some hardcore anti-Semites, they invoke Jehovah, they invoke, you know, Jewish deities and so on. And, you know, it's just, with all due respect for Michael Jones, he's a good colleague of mine, We were in several times together, and then we were also corresponding. He's a man of enormous erudition, but I just don't agree fully with that, you know. Neither do I agree with some of my friends who are churchgoers and so on. I know it's a sensitive issue. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, folks. But let's be honest here. Well, criticizing the Jews, yet at the same time accepting them as my alter ego through their religion, or through their deities, or through their concept of linear history unfolding in a paradise one of these days. This concept is completely strange, because after all, my identity goes back to my Illyrians and to Celts and to early Croats, thousands and thousands of years back. So I don't necessarily want to define my identity with Catholic Croats. So there are also Croats, right, who are not Catholics, and, or for that matter, Germans and so on. It's a tough issue, and I wouldn't like to confuse your viewers and your listeners. But again,
no, it's something we have to come to terms with. And hear me from my experience as a Macedonian. Of course, we were a predominantly Orthodox Christian nation, but there is a significant minority of Macedonians who are Muslim. Right, we call them Muslim Macedonians. They're distinct from Albanians. They're distinct from Turks, and they are part of our nation. The communist regime worked very hard to drive a wedge between us, because they like to do these things. They like to divide people, slice them up. They set up the incentives within Macedonia to basically marginalize the Macedonian Muslims, or to Albanize them, to make them believe they are Albanians. This has sadly worked in many ways, and especially after the seizure of Arabat Babateke, which was the religious center of Macedonian Islam in 2002 by the Albanian-controlled Islamic faith community. This has just happened. But religious identity, it's real. People care about it, and obviously, it's been historically important. Today, it is important. But if you are at the point where Catholic bishops are now calling for Muslim immigration, really the whole point of having a religious identity is lost. And of course, our racial and ethnic identities, they do not go away just because we have decided to ignore them. People have often said your skin is your uniform in the coming conflicts. That's not something we can erase ourselves. And yeah, people have said the non-whites are our enemies. They're looking at us, and they're seeing white skin. They don't see Catholic. They don't see Croat. They don't see Macedonian.
Good, very good point. So actually, we can wind down this discussion. That's my major point. I don't want to sound like...
Yeah, have you any summarizing, closing thoughts? Because we are getting close to the end.
I basically don't want to... And I'm not a... now trying to focus only on biological determinism, but I do argue that, of course, you can learn your culture, you can learn the foreign language, you can change your four passports. I've changed four passports now, four different citizenship in my life. Of course, you can learn a foreign language, you can learn even the mimicry of a foreign country you live, like you have a Bollywood, you know, Bollywood is the mimicry of Hollywood, or you can have a blacks dressing up in nice tuxedos and look very much like whites. Or you can have even Mandela, you know, he's not walking in his tribal outfit, but he walks, he used to walk in a white outfit. And the same goes for different non-European in-groups, including Arabs, you know. They're now patrolling here the Croatian coast. They're trying to scoop up some white Croat ladies, and I'm not happy about this either. But they also mimic, you know, even when they mimic the English language, you can see the accent. You can see the accent in a figurative sense. They would like to become super European. They would like to double down. It's a good word. Double down on something that they hate, of course. But now things have changed. We've seen now when you release this self-control, like this guy who killed a couple of whites just the other day in the States. Then things going to get very nasty. So basically, my point is, yes, I'm not a biological determinist, but yes, my race, my gene pool is the prime element of my identity, and I certainly want to preserve it. With all due respect, of course, for different tribes and for different groups, and I have no illusions whatsoever. Once again, I must say we must reject this old-time nationalism of the early 20th century, try to find our common goal, try to find out first that we have something in common, our history. So I do identify myself much more with Homer than with the Bible itself. Although, look, being a cultural pessimist, I don't have many illusions whatsoever. Think about the civil wars or social wars in ancient Rome. Well, there was no Christ then, you know, there was no Jesus Christ, but they fought like crazy. And think about Troy, you know, Trojan War is part of our mythical identity. In fact, you can't live without, you cannot function. It's part of myself. It was also a very brutal war. So I wonder on the daily basis, how does a guy, let's say a Turkish fellow now, who lives in Erdogan's Turkey, how does he actually, in Troy, it's Western Turkey nowadays, not very far from Bodrum, further up north, you know. And then you look at Troy, it was a mythical town, but probably a real town. How does a Turkish fellow or a Muslim fellow, how does he relate to that? How does he understand the mindset of those former warriors who lived there? You can say the same thing about...
People were saying in the chat that most of the people we call Turks in modern Anatolia were for the greater part Armenians, and I believe they're called Ionic Greeks who converted to Islam, whereas the elite is more drawn from European Balkan populations, Macedonians, Serbs, and Bulgarians who converted. I have relatives who are quote-unquote Turkish who converted to Islam, one branch of the family, and they are now very rich and very powerful in Istanbul. So, and they still speak the language.
Same case. I don't know how folks...
They are blonder than I am.
Absolutely. Just like the Bosnian Croats. In fact, our former, who used to be a good friend of mine, was a minister of culture, Zlatko Hasanbegović, blonde guy. He's an urban fellow. He was an old Croatian Muslim family. Okay, so, you know, folks, keep in mind, during the Second World War, during the Ustashi of fascist Croatia, there were 12 generals, or 10 or 12 generals, were of Jewish ancestry, believe it or not, you know. Even Pavelić's wife, she was half Jewish anyway. It's a long story. And then, of course, there were quite a few of Muslims. The last minister, Alaj Begović, I think, the last minister in the Ustaše government was of Muslim origin. And, of course, the mosque itself was erected, was actually built during the fascist Croatia, Ustaše Croatia. And yes, of course, you know, Pavelić himself and Himmler had a very high opinion of Muslim fighters of different Waffen-SS divisions who were recruited in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So even, you know, and of course, you know, Pavelić was the guy, was a Palestinian fellow. He was received Palestinian fellow freedom fighter. It was a Hoja, what do you call the Imam. He was received by Pavelić and Himmler back 43, 42. I don't know exactly the data. So just to give you an idea, you know, religion is not necessarily the reflection of your identity. What is our identity? Is our gene pool, our character? It can be bad or ugly. Not to say, the least. I told you folks, I guess it's getting late a little bit, so I'm winding it down. Having said that, I'm not saying that the whites are better. I mean, I don't like this hierarchy, better or good or bad, or whatever that means.
Well, every race and every population
is own skill, adapted so for itself. Let them have their own life. I am from ethno-pluralism, but I'm against the mixture of the society because it kills not only our gene pool, it kills all culture whatsoever. And I would suggest to you, a good man, I lived in Algeria, I lived in Africa for 3 years, so I guess I met there some very fine people. But the minute they start mimicking something, they start imitating the otherness, which is not befitting, which doesn't fit in their character, then it becomes first grotesque, and then at some point it becomes like a self-denial and leads to war. We had it on so many, many occasions. So anyway, well, I'd like to thank you for your invitation. And I guess we can say a few words about my website and we can wind that down because I'm also losing my breath a little bit, but I certainly enjoyed talking to you, and I certainly would encourage your folks, if they're serious students, if they want to get some books or some idea, and if you organize some conferences, guys, either German, English, or French, like I had the other day. Yesterday I had a good speech for my French, for my German fraternity, in German language for 2 hours almost. I discussed about my latest piece, about the culture of remembrance and the culture of denial and self-denial. And this was my piece that also published in the Occidental Observer, and I wrote about this. And I certainly would like to talk a little bit about my books. And I would suggest you to read my book dealing with ancient myths and former myths. It's a collection of essays. Titans Are in Town. The first half of the book is my essay. Actually, it's my novella. It's like a short novel. And the second part is very footnoted and deals with former myths and modern myths. And we have quite a few of modern myths and quite a few of modern hoaxes, including the last one. Now we know which way, you know, this COVID hoax and COVID panic, and we can discuss about this some other time. So, folks, be prepared. Just stay open and read. And what else can I tell you? I mean, closing statements. I mean, should I talk about my hippie days when I...
Maybe some other time.
I was in Hindu Kush in Kabul.
And maybe some other time.
Exactly. When was that? Jim Morrison died in 71. And this was 27. I was in Amsterdam on the road. I was 18 years of age. I fled, I mean, from communism. I fled from my parents. I kept reading, though. You know? And then the year after, I went from Denmark. I was there with some lady and so on. I was a young boy. And I went over, I crossed from Italy to Brindisi, and then across Turkey to Afghanistan and Kabul, of course, Herat.
This is all very, very fascinating. We should have an entire show just on your experiences.
Sure, yeah. I mean,
traveling through Afghanistan.
I have to show you the picture. You wouldn't recognize me. With my earrings and so on and so on. But it was a good experience for me because I look for a challenge in your life. You know, if you just want to vegetate in front of your TV and get stoned on some cheap stuff, it's no good for you, folks. I went through it myself. Get yourself a degree if you're younger. Get yourself a degree. Dress up finely. Avoid tattoos. Avoid, you know, earrings and all this. I went through it. You know, it will help you. It will get you, because you will infiltrate the system better. You'll fight the system better, especially with a degree, you know. So you'll know that basically we are surrounded by lies. Orwell wrote about this, 47, 48. You probably don't even, some of you folks don't even realize that Orwell had a hard time with the publishers in 47, 48, even when he published his first essay on the English language and the manipulation of the English language. Study the criminal code of different countries, study foreign languages, keep writing, and, you know, just be kind and nice to everybody and stay always within the law. Don't move outside the law. We're in a big culture war. We're in a Kulturkampf. So do not let the Antifas or the white or the leftist academics defame us or brand us as hicks or as toothless idiots or peasants. It's the finest people I've ever met are folks in Tennessee or, for that matter, in Mississippi. You know, they're very fine people, very old-fashioned, but always willing to help. I'm always welcome there. So
theirs is an honor culture, and they still honor guest rights.
I don't care. I mean, I'm sick and tired looking. I'm pretty much of a Einzelgänger, what do you call it, a lone wolf. I mean, of course, because I know lots of people, but I prefer being alone because I get tired of this leftist lingo you hear 24 hours, 7 days a week. This is such a big... Yes, I guess we could spend an hour just talking about self-censorship in U.S. academia and European politics and how this self-denial basically is a form of genetic, I can say, devolution. You know, Konrad Lorenz wrote about this. You know, please do read Konrad Lorenz. You know, the self-denial, even folks I know personally, I'm not going to mention them. Well, I know those folks. So no, I'm not bragging about this. Unfortunately, it's such amazing how folks can be bought for cheap money and anyway. So, guys, keep reading. Get yourself proper, well-groomed. Get yourself a degree. I mean, I might probably need your help with some mechanical stuff or technical stuff. I know very little about computers or smartphones, but I guess I have a pretty good sense of the metaphor. I can think fast and I can come up with new words. And the minute you say a certain word, I can think about 20 different synonyms or antonyms, also different languages as well.
So anyway, I think that's, I've noticed, because I'm a speaker of German myself, a little bit, I'm very rusty. I noticed that once you internalize the German way of word construction, German vocabulary, and German grammar, then the world just seems to make a little more sense. I think it's because you see these concepts floating around. This is the way I see it. Concepts float around in my head, and whenever necessary, they merge to create a new concept. They interlink with each other, or can separate and interlink in a different way. And that's you know, the great advantage of the German language. We have had donations on DLive, but we are all out of time. I know Gaius Maximus donated to Diamond, and he said that this is a clinic. I think he meant that in the positive sense, that you are very popular, Dr. Sunich. The chat loves you. We had, I think the peak number of viewers was 340 across all platforms on DLive and Odyssey. And this has been the Writer's Block with Dr. Tomislav Sunic. We have discussed the breakup of Yugoslavia and the implications and the lessons we can learn as distance in the Western context. I am Nicholas Argilvi, your friend and host, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye, people, and take care.